Hello, and welcome to episode 11 of the Blue Cup Tools podcast. I am Francisco Gonzalez, also known as Grundislav, and with me, as always...
Hi, Grundislav. I'm Ben. How are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you? It's been a while.
It has been a while. It really has.
It's been a while since we recorded an official podcast, but lots of stuff has happened in the interim.
A lot. Do you know where I'm sitting right now?
Where are you sitting right now?
Remember when I was playing Bioshock when you were at my house and I was sitting in this chair?
Yes, I do.
That's where I'm sitting. And you were sitting right over there on the floor, even though I offered you a more comfortable place to sit.
I should probably address that. One of the biggest milestones, I suppose, or one of the biggest events that happened since the last time we
were on the podcast. Was it not about a 14,000 milestone?
Clever. Thereabouts. Yes, you did. One of the big milestones that's happened since we recorded our last official podcast is that we finally met in person. And not only did we meet in person, but we spent the better part of 3.5 weeks in each other's constant presence.
Hello.
Hello.
Good. And just to clarify how big a step this is, the time here is currently 12:30 p.m. What is the time for you, Grundislav?
It's 12:30 a.m.
We are in perfect opposites. We're at perfect opposite sides of the world. So, yeah. That's pretty crazy.
Time zone wise, we are. Yeah, I've never bothered to map it geographically. I don't know if I could dig a tunnel and come out right where you are, but you know,
not quite. But it would be worth it because it's not that far to walk, and it'd be worth it just to come and visit me again, I'm sure.
Well, I think it would probably take less time to catch another flight and come visit you again than it would to dig through.
But it's the thought that counts.
Yeah, I guess so.
It's the thought that counts. Where's your sense of adventure? You're an adventure player.
I have lots of adventure. Do you not remember?
Yeah, we did. Actually, we had a great
season. Do you not remember the adventures we had? We recorded a podcast while fishing.
That was pretty crazy. We didn't catch a single fish that day.
No,
not that we fished for very long.
No, but we caught plenty of fish the next day. Well,
and we caught friendship. We caught friendship.
Yeah.
Don't laugh. Don't mock.
And we also caught
emotional sentiment. Yeah.
We also caught the nerd flu.
Yeah, we did.
And we passed it.
But anyway,
I was an infectious carrier, and I infected both you and Layabout, and it went full circle.
We didn't have our antivirus installed.
No, we certainly didn't.
Norton. let's move on because we're getting distracted, and we're getting distracted onto bad things, which is not what we want to do. How are you going, Cortisar? Have you been playing games lately? I don't know why I'm asking this question because we talk every day.
Well, we talk every day, but
we
don't talk to the public every day.
Hi, public.
Hi, public.
Lovely to meet you again.
Indeed. Say something nice about us and we'll make more podcasts or something. We need validation. Hmm. At least I do.
I'm quite happy to do whatever.
I've been playing games. Have you been playing games?
I have certainly been playing games. And mostly at the moment, I've been playing a lot of old DOS games. Some real favorites of mine and some that I've found on eBay that I've never played before and had no idea what they are. And I've been sort of chronicling the screenshots of them because we do a lot of low-res art in our games, you and I. Both as sort of AGS designers. And I really love to look at when professional artists were doing low-res art, you know, people that were trained to do art. I love to look at what they used to do and how we can learn from them. So I love to go back and see what sort of shortcuts they used, what sort of techniques they used back in the day. And now there are a ton of beautiful DOS games. I love VGA graphics.
You say that you've been chronicling the screenshots. Might there be a website where we could go visit these screenshots?
Yes, there might be, and there might not be.
Really? Well, why don't you tell us the web address so we can go look at them after we've finished listening to this podcast? Or during.
We could probably go to dos-ist-gut.tumblr.com and see them.
You mean DOS?
37 games.
DOS-IST-GUT.tumblr.com?
I absolutely mean that.
Good.
Absolutely. I think I've put about 37 games up there of all all different genres, not just the adventure genre, because I want to focus on all DOS games, because they're all, well, they're not all pretty, but the pretty ones are. But anyway, so recently I replayed a real favorite of mine, probably my favorite adventure game ever, a game called Full Throttle. And you also played it through again, Grimdeslav. How did you find it?
Oh, man, I found it just as fantastic as ever. But here's something interesting that I later came to find out. First of all, I should say that, yes, I played Full Throttle, and I used ScumVM to play it. I know that you are a big fanatic of DOSBox, and you don't often use ScumVM.
I like ScumVM, but if I can use DOSBox, I will.
Yeah. No, it's understandable. Both have their pros and their cons. I personally like using ScumVM because it usually has the cycles already tuned to the LucasArts games, and I don't have to fiddle with that too much. But I played Full Throttle on ScumVM, and there's also a sister program called ResidualVM, which allows you to run the LucasArts games that use the Grim E engine, like Grim Fandango and Escape Monkey Island. So my intent was to have a double feature and play Full Throttle and Grim Fandango, but as you know, Full Throttle is a little on the short side. You could finish it easily in one sitting in about 3 hours. Grim Fandango, on the other hand, takes a while. So I still haven't gotten around to playing Grim Fandango. It's still on my list. But Full Throttle was great. And an interesting thing that I learned was, apparently, the version of ScumVM that I had at the time, because I've since upgraded it, apparently there was some sort of issue some sort of bug in the old mine road sequence. I don't know what exactly it was, but if you recall, I was talking to you after I played it, and I said that it took a while for me to run into that first vulture that you have to throw the fertilizer into her eyes.
Yes, the one with the chainsaw.
Yeah, it took an unusually long time to run into her. Usually she's like the second or third person that you run into, and it took like over 15 times to run into her. So I'm wondering I'm wondering if maybe that was the bug. But either way, I was able to finish the game. And man,
And it's a great game. I love Full Throttle. Like I said, it's probably one of my favorite. In terms of like adventure games as a whole, it's as like point and clicks, is probably my favorite. For a number of reasons. But there's something that you mentioned to me while you were playing it, or after you'd played it, that you noticed about the art style and how much influence it had had on my art style.
Yes, that's true. I noticed quite a bit that the palettes and basically the level of detail, the level of detail and the use of the foreground objects and things like that, it was very reminiscent of your style. Or maybe I should say your style is very reminiscent of that.
Yeah,
unless you're some sort of time traveler.
Unless we're in backwards world.
Ew.
Yes. So anyway, so what I thought we should talk about today is finding an art style and developing your art style and just finding a style that you like and experimenting with different art styles and finding inspiration for art styles. Because I think this is a very important subject. I often find I play games like Crysis and I play games like Far Cry 2. And one thing I really miss in a lot of modern technology with all the different shaders and the different things we can do with the graphics now is that we often go for realism and abandon having a style. I remember playing Crysis when Crysis first came out, and I played it on my PC and I was amazed at how realistic everything looked. Except it just felt very bland to me, you know. Everything had been rendered to look real, and so there was no, for me anyway, you know, there was no real interest in exploring the world, because who cares? It looks like a real world. I'm not interested in, you know, if I want to walk around things, I'll walk around outside, personally.
True. Well, yeah, it's interesting you say that.
So I find games...
Because you make me think of a game that is famous probably for its realistic look, or at least high resolution textures and an attempt to look realistic, which is Half-Life 2. Now,
yes.
Half-Life 2 is very realistic looking. But then you have environments like City 17, which, while they look realistic, they're designed in such a way that they're still visually appealing. And an interesting link to that is Dishonored, which, as we both, I believe you said it was your...
We both played
and we both enjoyed greatly. I said it was my game of the year for 2012. I think you may have expressed similar sentiments.
Yes, it was mine as well.
Yeah. Dunwall was actually designed by one of the lead designers of City 17. And if you take...
It absolutely was.
Yeah, but if you contrast the hyper-realistic or the photorealistic style of Half-Life with that sort of painterly look of Dishonored, they're both interesting environments, but I would say Dunwall oozes a bit more style, obviously.
I think Dunwall had a bit more technology behind it, but you do mention City 17, which is a great example of a city that feels like a real city, but also feels like somewhere we've never been before, and therefore you want to explore it. And that's what I really love in a game. You want to have this sort of sense of mystery, a little bit of alien feel about it, or a bit of foreign feel about it. So it's, you know, it encourages exploration. The setting itself should encourage exploration. You should have an environment that makes you curious and makes you wonder, like, how does this work? What's this?
Which is one of the main draws of adventure games, of course, as we've said.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I really find that when I get a game like this, like you mentioned, Dishonored has this fantastic city to explore. I think BioShock has this underwater city, which is just oozing with sort of potential. I finally managed to get you to play Deus Ex Human Revolution, and I think what they did there with real world cities is just fantastic. It feels like a real city, but it feels like a real city in the future. So it's much more, you want to find out what things do and how it works, I think.
Well, as I told you, when I played the moment, there's always a bit of a moment of hesitation when you play a new game, you know. If it's not one you pick out yourself and someone recommends to you, there's always sort of that little lingering doubt in the back of your mind where you think, am I really going to like this? And, you know, you kind of hope that you do, because you don't want to tell the person that recommended the game to you, oh yeah, I didn't like that game, you know. unless you hate that person, and then you're just like, ha ha, fuck you, I didn't like it. I would say that the moment, because Deus Ex Human Revolution, for those who have played it or who haven't played it, I don't care. I'm not going to spoil anything, but basically it starts off with a tutorial-ish level, you know, and then you get sort of a main mission, and you don't really get to explore a city hub until quite a fair bit into the game, at least an hour's worth of gameplay into the game, is that you start exploring the, you know, besides that, it's just standard sort of first person shooting, sneaking around that those kinds of mechanics. But the moment I think that Deus Ex Human Revolution really went from, I wonder if I'll like this game, to this game is awesome, was that moment when I was wandering around the city hub of Detroit, and I was just walking around, and it felt like it was incredibly immersive, you know. I remember I turned my head, my in-game camera, I looked over to, I think it's the section right near the limb clinic, where you can pan up and there's a giant billboard for Picus and you see Eliza and all that. And just seeing that level of detail and all the stuff that they made this world be, I just thought, okay, I think this is a game for me.
Yeah, yes. I agree. I think what they managed to do with Deus Ex Human Revolution is the previous two games, you've played some of Deus Ex, you haven't played any of Invisible War, but they never really break...
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know you'd finished it. Oh, yeah, of course.
What are you talking about?
Okay, so what I've found the first two Deus Ex games, both of which I like, they have interesting art styles, but it never really feels like a real place. I found the third game, some of the locations, they feel very real world. There's a lot of detail in things like boxes and just basic paraphernalia on, you know, clutter. They put a lot of clutter into the game, which makes it feel real world, and they could have fallen into the Crysis trap of just having this boring real world, but then they've stuck to a very, very amber color palette. They've given a lot of futuristic textures to things, and it really breaks free of the real-world trappings once again. and immerses you in this completely exotic setting, even though it also at the same time feels totally familiar. So I really love games that do this. This really appeals to me, you know?
Yeah.
And I like games that break the tropes, like Cyberpunk. When you think Cyberpunk, when you think Cyberpunk settings, you always think of cool colors, you know? The Matrix was all rendered in a lot of greens. Ghost in the Shell had lots of blues. You know, the second Deus Ex had a lot of blue. I mean, Ghost in the Shell, I will admit, the second film has quite a lot of orange in it. But it's really refreshing for me to see a Cyberpunk game that's not green and it's not blue. It makes me really excited about this. You know, I mean, it's such a simple thing, but I love the fact that they dared to do this when, you know, I mean, there's the Avalon live action thing, but you know, yeah, Cyberpunk literally is blue and green.
I've always wondered about something, mm-hmm. and the classification of the genre cyberpunk, that's an interesting sort of word there, because cyberpunk just makes me think of, like, a guy with a mohawk with some sort of visual implant that makes him part machine. What exactly is cyberpunk trying to impart?
I like to think that cyberpunk is a mix between advanced technology to the point where technology and organisms such as humans, the line is blurring between what is so, and the punk bit I like to think is quite anarchist, quite dystopian, quite a bit of unrest. So it's an anti-authority kind of thing. Like punk music was quite anti-authority. I believe that's what cyberpunk means.
Because then you have steampunk, which is essentially just like people wearing top hats and funky goggles and that sort of thing.
Sure.
Which I guess is the same thing, I think.
Yeah, but a lot of steampunk things, you know, you see people with these giant warrior blimps. It's people fending for themselves. It's back to a more feudal system, I guess. You know, gangs and yeah, stuff like that. So
Okay.
That's cyberpunk for me.
Would you consider Blade Runner cyberpunk?
Would I consider Blade Runner cyberpunk? You're ridiculous. Yes, Blade Runner is cyberpunk.
Yeah, well, Blade Runner doesn't strike me as particularly blue or green. Blade Runner is very black and rainy.
I suggest you go back and particularly watch some of the scenes towards the end. It's very blue.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's been a while since I saw the movie, and it's been even longer since I played the game, which I have somewhere and I should probably dig up.
I have it sitting right here, not very far from me.
I see. I have it in a plastic box behind me somewhere.
Good. Good. Mm. So I think moving on from sort of real-world settings, I like it moving through like the cyberpunk feel again. I like games like Aquanox that really, they take it even further. But you see a lot of submarine games, and they have an underwater setting, and underwater can be pretty bland. I mean, underwater is amazing because it's like space, but it's totally claustrophobic. So unlike space where you can look around and you can see a zillion planets and stars and everything like that, underwater you can see nothing. You know, you can only see the slightest little bit. So I love games like Aquanox where you've got this sort of this dark environment, but it's been mixed with all this futuristic stuff. So it feels like, once again, it's underwater, but it's fresh, you know. It's not playing Echo the Dolphin over again. It's this fresh new setting. I like playing... I played Subwar 2050 recently, and they have this idea where they've got these grids that show the levels, the different heat levels in the water. So you can go from a hot spot to a cold spot, and you can you can pilot your submarine through these sort of grids, and it hide from enemies on their radar, and it gives it this really sort of futuristic feel. It's not realistic at all, but I think the best thing an art director can do, or someone looking for art direction, is break rules and see what works. You know, throw different things at the wall, even if it's not... You know, we get stuck in tropes so often, you know? Like cyberpunk being blue, we get stuck in these tropes. Sometimes you want to throw things at the wall and see what sticks and see what doesn't. One of my favorite games on the PlayStation 3 is Enslaved: Odyssey to the West. Now, there have been a ton of these sort of post-apocalyptic games made, especially recently. You've got your Fallout 3, Fallout New Vegas. You know, a while ago you had Stalker, the various Stalker games. You had Singularity. You had, is it Metro? I don't even know what that one is. You've got, like, The Last of Us. Yeah, and then you've got stuff like Rage, which are all cool games. But Enslaved does this sort of post-apocalyptic setting, and post-apocalyptia is always dull and dreary. And I've played a lot of post-apocalyptic games, and when you play Enslaved Odyssey to the West, it's bright, it's vivid, the colours are just so intense, greens and oranges and everything like this. And to play this sort of post-apocalyptic game where it's the whole world's a wasteland of crumbled buildings and everything like this, but to see it rendered in such a colourful style, you know, and they made sure that every place had its set pieces and everything like that, I really love it. It's a breath of fresh air for me. It's this exuberant sort of nature has taken back over, and it's all plants and luscious life, and I think that's such a clever idea. You know, it's so fantastic to have that sort of idea, you know. And on the other side, we've got Mirror's Edge, where they've done this huge, big future city and everything like that, and everything's so Spartan, you know? They've taken away all the trappings of cyberpunk, which are sort of grey and drab and dull, and, you know, and they've got these huge blue skies and these white buildings. It looks fantastic. I wish more games were this daring.
I only ever played a demo of Mirror's Edge, but I remember being struck by how clean everything was.
Yeah, it's a very bold design decision in a sort of environment where most people are looking to clutter up their environments. You know, you play something like Mirror's Edge, which was the other, not Mirror's Edge, Assassin's Creed, which was the other free-running game that came around the same time as Mirror's Edge, and they made sure that everything was sort of cluttered and lots of detail and everything like this. And I really love the contrast between playing the two of those. Mm. So, for our personal sort of, for what we do as, you know, game designers, and particularly the graphics department of game designers, I think it's important to not only play new games and look at things and look at films and stuff like that, but to also play old games and see what people did back then. I've noticed in your style some Gabriel Knight shines through, particularly in the character portraits.
Oh, well, I take a lot of inspiration from the old Sierra games. I know that you're not a Sierra fan, and I'm slowly trying to...
I'm slowly changing. I love Quest for Glory.
Yeah, here's the problem, though, and we've had this conversation, but I want our listeners to know. I want our listeners to know that you have played Sierra games, but you have made the unlucky mistake, whether through some sort of terrible serendipity or just really bad choices on your part purposely. You've played most of the major series, but you've chosen to play some of the worst entries in those series. You've played
Shall I list them off?
Well, so, I'll list them and you tell me if I'm correct or not. So, you've played of Space Quest, you've played Space Quest 2.
Yes.
Okay. Arguably, and people will probably, the diehards will probably have words with me, but I would say Space Quest 2 is arguably the worst one in the series, because it's got unfair mazes and dead ends, and it just is not, it's not a well-designed game, but they were still learning. Okay. Anyway, you've played Police Quest 3?
Yes,
which is terrible on all accounts. I think that one is pretty universally agreed is terrible. You played King's Quest. I believe you said you had played King's Quest. I don't remember which.
Only the first.
Okay.
I've played a little bit of 6, just a tiny little bit of 6, but only the first King's Quest.
Okay. Well, the first King's Quest is, it's not a bad game, it's just very dull, is all. It's essentially just fairy tales. 6 is the best one. You should play King's Quest 6. Don't play King's Quest 5 unless you just want to laugh at Cedric. I'm trying to think. That's about it, really. Haven't you played?
I had played as a kid. I used to love the Quest for Glory 5 demo, and until this year, I had only ever played also Quest for Glory 3. And I didn't get into it. But I played Quest for Glory 1 this year, and I loved it. I loved it very, very much. So
good.
Well, see, I'm shining to it. I had played Gabriel Knight 3. until last year when I started playing Gabriel Knight 1. And Gabriel Knight 1 is superior to Gabriel Knight 3.
Well, yeah.
In every way.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm slowly warming up to Sierra.
Okay.
I recently bought EcoQuest, so that could be the Death Note, or that could be the I don't know, but
No comment. Had you played hold on. I'm trying to think, what was it? Shoot, it was on the tip of my tongue. What was it?
I've played some Phantasmagoria. Phantasmagoria sucks.
I'm never gonna play it again. No, don't do that. Phantasmagoria is terrible. But, yeah. Anyway, yeah, so basically, you have played some of the lesser... Oh, Leisure Suit Larry. Have you played any of the Leisure Suit Larry games?
Oh, yeah. Leisure Suit Larry 2, which everybody has said, oh, man, what did you play that for? And I have to say, I stuck with Leisure Suit Larry 2 for as long as I could before it defeated me. I got stuck in a spot and I didn't have enough saves because I'd been saving like a paranoid idiot every 2 seconds because I'm like, I'm going to die again. And so I'm like, well, I'm not replaying this whole pile of crud just to see, you know, because it, fuck Larry too.
Well, yeah, sort of. That's kind of the point, but yeah. Anyway, I took a picture of all of my game boxes today, and I realized that my games collection, box-wise, you can't really tell. Well, you can... Box-wise, if we go box-wise, it would look like I have a lot more Sierra games than I have LucasArts games. But actually, I do have more Sierra games than I have LucasArts games. But that's on account of Sierra having put out way more sequels than LucasArts ever did.
Yes.
But my art style is very much trying to imitate the old Sierra VGA games of yore, which is that sort of scanned VGA art style. Now, it was pretty apparent in the Ben Jordan games that that's what I was trying to go for, except I've thankfully moved away from the whole dithering thing, which is a staple of the Sierra backgrounds. So yeah, I'm kind of evolving into my own thing, and I've taken tips from you, from Sergeant Sweetstin. So I would say that currently my style is a sort of a weird love child of old Sierra with Ben 304 tricks. So and we'll see how it keeps evolving. But
good.
Yeah, I've don't get me wrong, I love LucasArts, but I've never quite been able to wrap my head around how they did it. Because Sierra, I know that they did their fair share of like oil paintings that they would scan in and stuff. And I know that LucasArts, like for Monkey Island 2, had those markers that they would draw on the paper with,
sure,
which you hate in contrast to a lot.
Well, I guess my biggest problem with Monkey Island 2, other than anything else, is that it just came out so messy compared to Monkey Island 1, which was neat and beautiful.
Well, that's because Monkey Island 1 was done in deluxe paint, where like pixel by pixel was placed, and Monkey Island 2, they did it with these markers, and they didn't, you know, they did cleanup, but there's only so much cleanup you can do. So,
it a lot more if it was cleaner.
Yeah, I know that they did, obviously with the high res, like Curse of Monkey Island, they did the whole drawing on paper, scanning, whatever, which I attempted to do once, and it was way too much work. But games like Full Throttle and The Dig and Day of the Tentacle and stuff like that, like I've never been able to really figure out if it was scanned or if it was somehow not scanned. I don't know. You've mentioned that you think Full Throttle is drawn on paper and scanned. But I don't know.
I think there's a whole range of techniques. There's a whole range of techniques they use. If you look at some of the things in The Dig, like some of the spots once you get into like where the weird train sphere thing is, if you compare all of the different stops for the train, they all look like the same scene rendered with different colors.
Yeah.
So there's a few little tricks there that that, you know, that nobody really knows. I think, you know, they got to the point where they were half rendering stuff. They were doing a bit of everything. So but I don't think you can pin LucasArts down to any one star.
Yeah, after Day of sort the of... Tentacle. The Day of the Tentacle, I would suspect just the color palette reminds me sort of Monkey Island 2, but it's cleaner than Monkey Island 2, and there's some anti-aliasing happening a lot that makes me think that it looks like it was done in Photoshop at high res and scaled down, that kind of effect that you get when you do that. But I don't know. Mm. I just can't figure out how it is. So basically, my point is, I've never really been able to successfully emulate...
If you're a listener...
Yeah, well, first of all, if you're a listener and you have some insight onto how LucasArts did these things, please let us know, because we really want to know. But also, I've never really been able to successfully emulate that LucasArts style. I've always felt more comfortable trying to emulate the Sierra style as a guideline.
It's because you don't use your tablet brush with the opacity setting on the pressure sensitivity enough.
Yeah, I guess that's it. I'm slowly learning. I'm slowly getting there. But
I will get listen now, listeners of our podcast. If you have a tablet and you're trying to paint backgrounds, and you do not set your pressure sensitivity to opacity, try it and stick with it, because
this is
why tablets are great. I'm just telling you right now.
Made a big difference with me. I will.
And use soft edges brushes sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. But not too much.
A lot. And also use really big brushes. If you're working at 320 by 200 and you need to shade something like a wall or something like that, use a size 300 brush. Don't be scared. Stop being scared now. I'm here for you.
Look, next time we see each other in person, you teach me these things. Because
I found it interesting. One of the things that we did as part of our sort of Australia adventure was go and visit some people everywhere else. And one of the people we visited was Dane Krams, who's Sully on the forums, who does lovely artwork. He does this lovely cartoony high-res artwork. And I found it really interesting to just sit for a while and watch him and sort of do his thing. I learned some things just watching him, you know. And we sort of discussed things and gave each other tips and stuff like that. And I painted three pictures on his computer, I think, just real quick speed paintings, but showing him some of the stuff I do. So it's really interesting to watch someone else paint. I don't know if you've ever sort of gone on YouTube and looked up speed paintings or speed painting demonstrations or painting discussions, but you can learn a lot watching other people paint. Not necessarily a tutorial, because a tutorial, people try and force their style down your throat. I think you should sample as many different styles as you can, try them all and see what works for you. You know, unless I'm shouting at you to do something the right way, because then you have to do what I say, because I'm such a sweet skin.
I'm a bit saddened and a bit slightly envious that I didn't get a chance to see any sort of tutorial. I was very anti-technology, anti-computer in Australia. I wanted to get away from that for a while, because, you know, I'd been working on my game pretty heavily, and I had just been to GDC, so, you know, I wanted to get away from all that. But yeah, I kind of wish I had seen some of that stuff, especially with Dane and with you, and even well, I did kind of see when you were painting on you painted the lady on the tablet.
Yeah, I hated that. I hate painting on tablets because I'm not used to it, so I really had trouble doing that. Also, if you hear rustling, I'm sifting in my seat, but the listeners like that. They like hearing the sort of little home comforts. So
yeah,
I think if we're gonna talk about influences, I like to wear my influences on my sleeve. You know, I like people to know this is what I'm trying to make. You know.
Oh, absolutely. So, Jordan was obviously me trying to make Gabriel Knight 7 or 10 times.
Other than So when I joined the AGS forums, one of the users that I really looked up to, and I love the graphics in his game still, was a guy called Bernie, and he did Reacto 9, and he I can't even think of what it's called, the one with the little elf guy and the...
I can't remember either.
I didn't do my research for this podcast. Play Bernie's games, because they're amazing, and he had stuff like Hero Theorem and stuff like that. And I really like these perfect pixel characters over these bright, colorful Photoshop painted backgrounds. So that's what I started aiming for, you know. Once I got myself a tablet and I'd moved past this really pixely style that I was doing, I really wanted to go for a look like his. And over the years, I've played stuff like The Journey Down. I've played stuff like Resonance, Primordia, the Blackwell Convergence, Gemini Rue. And I take every time I play these games, I'm looking at them. I'm looking, going, what looks good? How can I take some influence from this game and make it, you know, not steal? Because I don't think you should steal as an artist. Well, obviously you shouldn't. Stealing is naughty. Thief.
Good artists. Bad hamburger. Artists copy, great artists steal, as they say, as I believe Picasso said. Also, by the way,
Lumpy.
Well, yeah, but the game you were mentioning is Cedric and the Revolution.
Yes, of course, which has nothing to do with Sierra Owls and bad voice acting.
No, yes.
And so, and as you know, I took sort of, I was really inspired by Ben Jordan 6. I was really inspired by the Second Apprentice game. All of these games that I played, you know, I sort of took notes on board. And your own style becomes a sort of amalgamation of everything that you see, and you take something from everything and you put it into your own work and make it your own. And you get this really nice thing where if you're not sure of having a style and you don't know where to start, because being an artist, drawing a game, if you've had no art training, like I had no art training, had no idea, you need to look and see what other people do, you know. You can't write a book until you've read books and know how words work together. So
well, also,
why would you even try just without knowing how to do it?
It's not even not having any art training. Even if you have some sort of art training, if you've taken art classes and stuff, painting stuff on the computer is a completely different medium. It's like being trained in oil painting and then being told to create a thing in pastels. It's completely different technique. It's a completely different way of the things working, and you might be amazing at one thing but terrible at another. So it really is just a matter of growing to feel comfortable with however you do things. I mean, before you got a tablet, I'm assuming you used to draw with the mouse, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so did I. And even that is a completely different thing. You have to use the mouse every now and then because there's certain things that's easier to do with the mouse than with a tablet. But
oh, I use the mouse constantly.
Yeah, so do I. But still, it's night and day, and you don't work exclusively with the mouse, or exclusively with the tablet, for that matter. But still, it's, yeah.
No. Yeah. So, but a lot of the sort of things that you can look at is when you're developing your style, is setting limits for yourself. I started with a really limited color palette. Well, I didn't start with that, but I ended up going towards really limited color palettes to get a really unified feel to my graphics, because I wanted you want the characters to be immersed in the world. You want the players to feel immersed because everything is immersed, you know. You want everything to look really consistent. So I used to limit my palette. I still limit my resolution, because if you've got big pixel characters over big pixel backgrounds, they're going to blend in slightly better, you know. If you set limits to yourself and say, I'm only going to use 5 colors for this painting, or I'm only going to use 2 colors for this painting, which is absolutely possible, you can totally do it, then you learn to work within these limits. And a lot of old games, you see stuff like Super Nintendo games, you know, they had these really limited palettes. And so what they used to do is they'd find all these little tricks, you know, about how you can make certain amounts of colors go further. And it gives it this really unique style. A lot of retro palettes, instead of, because they only had, you know, 16 colors or something like this, instead of going, you know, from dark to light, they'd go from one hue to another hue, and it gives it this really bright, vibrant look, you know. And not just like you see. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
You see a lot of artists do this, you know, it's called complementary colors, you know, a lot of artists do it, but never to the extent that it was done when people only had 16 colors.
I'm constantly impressed by the old backgrounds, the old EGA adventure, like Sierra backgrounds that would do that. Just certain backgrounds that you get so much contrast with 16 colors just by adding little black pixels in between. You have the same shade of green, but you have a solid green, and then you have the same green but with black pixels in between to make it look like it's a different shade when it's actually the same color, just dithered with black pixels.
Right. You're mixing colors. I started, my first pixel art that I ever used to do was on my grandma's computer in Paintbrush in Windows 3.11. And you only had, I think you only had an EGA palette for that. And so when you wanted to draw like a light yellow, it automatically dithered things for you, which was, I couldn't understand why at first. I'm like, oh, this color's weird. But then I realized that the computer program is dithering for you. So that taught me basics of dithering and stuff like that, just because the program itself was so limited. So
that's pretty cool.
If you look at old technology like this, you see people working around limitations, you know, and you can really learn a lot from people doing that, because you might have all of the tools in the world available to you now. I mean, we've got stuff like alpha channels, you know, we've got enormous resolutions, we've got 3D rendering. There's so much we can do now that they couldn't back then. But if you look at the stuff that they did back then, sometimes that's more accessible for someone who's just starting out than picking up a tablet, starting up Photoshop and go, right, I'm going to paint a scene.
And yet the ironic thing is that we have all these things now, these new things available to us, and we spend our time making backgrounds that look like backgrounds that people made when they had limited color palettes and things.
But I don't think so. I mean, I've recently been working on stuff like, you know, Blackwell and some other stuff that I can't really talk about because they're not my games to talk about and they haven't been announced. So these people, you know, have asked me, you know, I want to do this, I want to do that, I want it to look like this. So I can sort of emulate an older style, but at the same time, I'm trying to make it look new. I want it to look fresh. I don't want people to look at it and go, oh, that's only 256 colors. I love VGA graphics. I'll be the first to say that VGA graphics are beautiful. I mean, I have my own blog dedicated to sort of cataloging beautiful VGA screenshots. But I think for a modern product, sometimes it helps to have, you know, millions and millions of colors. I've said this before, I don't think there's enough colors. I can't get certain things to blend like they should. I think computers need more colors than they have. So, yeah.
Well, I would agree with you. I think that there's a certain point where adventure games especially went from being VGA 256 colors to sort of more high-res Visa, if you were in DOS, SVGA. And there's just certain games that I think just look better. I mean, 256 color games just look better on the whole. Because not only did they, it seemed like since they had access to 3D and stuff, there was a lot more 3D rendering going on with the backgrounds, so the backgrounds look a lot more artificial. Like, take a game, like, for example, I don't know, we'll say King's Quest VI. Look at those backgrounds. They're nice, they're lush, they're pretty, they have nice
colors.
They're lovely. Yeah, they're 256 colors. Then let's take King's Quest VII, which is
hideous.
Yeah, it has high-res backgrounds, which have obviously been drawn, but there's also a lot of weird 3D rendering going on. There's some very strange dithering happening with the colors. The sprites look like they were done in MS Paint. It just, I don't know what they were thinking, but it just is weird.
I think they were trying to look like Disney, to be honest.
Well,
it upsets me that they tried this because it didn't really work.
Yeah. But hey, at least it's not FMV. But I'm getting on a tangent.
Yeah. So anyway, so I think the key to this discussion, which is finding your own art style or, you know, learning from other art styles, is to really sample as much different stuff as possible. I love playing games. I am not exaggerating when I say on my shelf sitting, you know, a couple of meters from me, I have about 500 different games on different cartridges on different things. And I really love to see all the different art styles. You've got your Double Fines with your ultra, you know, stylized graphics and stuff like that. Then you've got stuff like A Whispered World and A New Beginning with their really comic book kind of look. I love looking through all these different games and going, oh, you know, how have they done it? What have they done? Looking at the sort of the choices they've made. I think a lot of times when you're starting a game, you have, it's kind of weird because you never really know what a game looks like until you've drawn the first scene, Once you've drawn that first scene, you've got a reference point. This is what my game looks like, you know. Once you've done your first little bit of concept drawing, you know. I mean, you always have pictures in your head. But so to look at other games and go, oh, you know, like I look around my walls at the moment and I've got a Bastion poster. I love the art style of Bastion. I think it's fantastic. I've got a Planescape Torment poster over here, which had a really alien sort of feel to the city. I tried to copy that in PS. Well, not copy it, but emulate it, you know. I've got Full Throttle poster over there. I love Full Throttle. I've got a Devil May Cry, the brand new one. I love what Devil May Cry did with the different, the really rich color schemes and some of this. I mean, it's a dumb, stupid game, but stylistically, it's very, very rich. You've got Resonance over there. I really like what Resonance did with its backgrounds. You know, they took the low-res feel, and I think it almost feels like concept art, some of the way it's been drawn. You know, behind me, I've got Machinarium. I've got A New Beginning. So even just my walls in my sort of where I draw my backgrounds, I'm surrounded by these inspirational pictures. And, yeah, that's really important to me, is to look at other things and go, why are they beautiful? Why do I like looking at these? And then taking that and putting it into your own work, you know? And even, and just especially playing the games. Because a game can never be represented well by a single image or by 10 images, you know? You really have to play it to feel how the animation works, how the game works as a unit.
True. But there's something that happens sometimes, which has happened to me, especially recently with A Golden Wake. If you haven't quite developed your own style and you draw something, and I know actually this happens to you because you've told me that it happens to you all the time.
Okay.
Is if you're constantly improving, constantly changing, and you're working on something over a long period of time, you might find that something you've drawn more recently doesn't quite match up to what you've drawn before. And then you might feel tempted to go back and make improvements to what you've drawn before. And sometimes you can do it. And sometimes you can't. So what would you say to people who, you know, who that happens to? If you draw, let's say you draw a background and you're really pleased with it. And 3 weeks down the line, you've been practicing and you've been doing speed painting or whatever to improve your technique. And you've learned a really cool new trick that makes your backgrounds look, you would say, 10 times better, and you draw a new background, and you're amazingly pleased with it, and then you look at your old background and you think, wow, that's crap. What would you say to someone in that case?
I would say to them, stop being a bloody idiot. That's what I'd say.
I see.
Look, here's the thing. You're always improving. You will always be improving. So if 3 weeks after doing one thing, sometimes it's a week you've done something, you go back and you go, oh man, that's not as good as it can be. Guess what's going to happen a week later, and a week later, and a week later?
Yeah.
Look, you're always going to be improving, all right? There's sometimes you'll learn a trick that's really quick, and it's really simple, and you can go back and you can add it. But if you get to the point where you're like, I really need to paint these first 10 scenes over again, you've totally missed the point. You've absolutely missed the point. Sorry, but it's true, you know. Imagine if, say, let's talk about Ben Jordan 8. Partway through Ben Jordan 8, you started doing stuff like the deluxe versions where you were trying out this style and you got a tablet and all of a sudden, you know, you had this great style. Imagine if you'd stopped working on Ben Jordan 8, scrapped, you know, I mean, you had 60-something backgrounds for the game. Scrap what you'd done on those and gone, right, I'm going to start over. Do you think the game would have been done by now?
No. Took long enough to get anyway. You know. But, yeah.
There you go. So you finish the project you're on with the style that you've got and go, right, now I've got more tools in my toolbox. I've got a more diverse range of techniques. I will go into a new project with a new mindset, you know. At the moment, I'm working on scene 39. I'm painting the 39th scene of the new Blackwell game. That's probably a spoiler. I don't think anybody really cares. So, you know, it's been a pretty long road. In the last year, I don't know, I've probably painted over 100 scenes, you know. And if I look at the stuff that I painted a year ago, it doesn't look much like the stuff that I'm painting now. But there's still a stylistic consistency because I'm still working with my own style, you know. So even though to you subjectively, you may be saying, oh, man, what an idiot, you know. Objectively, as a game, I believe that from start to finish, your project will still feel consistent. Mm. If you learn a trick that you can apply in 2 seconds, sure, go back and fix the other scenes. If you start throwing scenes out, then you're really missing the point, I think. Mm. It's a big trap to fall into. Once you start learning some art technique and you get this perfection mindset, because it happens to a lot of people, you get this real perfectionist mindset where you want to draw as good as you can, and it happens to all of us. My whole goal is to draw every scene as good as I can possibly make it, and sometimes you really can't. Sometimes you lack the skill, sometimes the scene's just not right for your sort of abilities, you know.
Sometimes
you need to sort
your you realize halfway through that the composition isn't the best it could have been.
Well, that's a lot of the time, stuff like that's why you rough out first. You know, you rough out a scene first, and if you're being commissioned to do something, then you send it off for approval or you discuss it, you know. But, yeah, always rough
but
stuff
sometimes,
out, like, even just, yes.
Sometimes even if you rough out a scene, just, and then you just realize halfway through that it's not going to work the way you originally envisioned it.
In that case, I say there's sort of halfway through, it's probably enough time to start over again. But even yesterday, I showed you a scene, and I knew just showing you the rough draft of it, I thought, oh man, I'm going to have to change this. And I did, and it was worth changing it, because now I'm happy with it. So don't start throwing scenes out, you know, in terms of quality, but because your style's changed, because your style will be constantly evolving. That's the most beautiful thing for me about art, is that it never gets boring, because you're always trying new stuff. And make sure you do keep trying new stuff. Like I said, I'm always looking to new influences, new inspirations, stuff I can add. I can spend hours online looking at people's paintings and drawings, and even 3D models you can learn a lot from. Hmm. Watch films. You know, all of my films in my collection of films are animated films, 2D animated films.
Because but you don't
I'm
watch
always
films.
Looking at the backgrounds. I do. I have some. But they're all animation films. So I'm always looking at the backgrounds. I'm always looking at the character animations. For me, that's the best thing about watching a film, is seeing what they've done stylistically that I can learn from. Take things, don't be afraid to take things away from stuff, you know. I remember when I first played The Journey Down, it was, I think, November 2009. And this, you know, Theo emailed me, and I'd never heard of the guy, and I thought, oh, I'll try his demo out, you know, this will be fun. And I was blown away by the style, absolutely blown away. And I instantly thought to myself, you know, I'd love to be able to draw like this. I'd love to have a style like this. I should learn, you know, I should learn to sort of do a style like this. I should add elements from this into my style. So don't be afraid to look at someone else and go, what have they done? How can I sort of learn from this? Same with Resonance. When I first played Resonance, which I think was also 2009, I was like, man, I'd love to be able to paint like this. I'd love to be able to do backgrounds like this. So I set about, you know, how can I sort of learn from these people? Don't be afraid to have people to look up to, people that influence you and inspire you.
Sure. I mean, it's no secret that I see your backgrounds and I say, man, I wish I could paint that backgrounds like that. So that's why I'm trying to sort of emulate your eye for detail. And for character portraits, Gabriel Knight was a big inspiration for Ben Jordan 8, but for Golden Wake, and ever since, I've kind of been leaning more towards emulating Big Brother's style for Blackwell. Not so much in his limited palette, because Big Brother is a master of using a limited palette for character portraits, but
very clever.
But
very,
kind of,
very clever.
Yeah, but kind of more along the lines of using kind of bolder outlines and a little bit more smooth blending type thing for the portraits. So, yeah.
Sure. It's good. It's good to have these people where you go, it's good to have a goal, I think. You have to set yourself a goal and go, this is my goal. I want my stuff to look like this or better. Never be afraid to go, I want to be better than this person. I want to be better than Rembrandt. It's a ridiculous thing to say, but at least you've got a goal, you know?
Yeah,
Luminous, you know, Luminous is backgrounds. I look at it and I go,
oh,
I want to do coloring like that. I want to do lighting like that. So, you know, I set about going, how can I sort of add elements from his style to all the other things I do?
I tried and failed to emulate Luminous's use of light in my Ben Jordan 8 backgrounds.
but at least I tried. Well,
you don't. Well, you're never going to get something straight away, are you?
No, of course you not. Know,
it takes a lot of work. So be aware that if something looks really good, it'll probably take a lot of practice.
Yeah.
And I paint and draw every day, and I improve. You know, I can see the improvement in my backgrounds. I can see the improvement in your backgrounds. Just this year alone, you have improved a remarkable amount.
Well, thank you. So,
you know, and this year alone, I feel I've improved as well. You know, I've learned a ton.
You have.
I've put all sorts of new tricks up my sleeve. So, yeah, this is why art is great. And if you're drawing every day, which, to be honest, if this is what you want to do, if drawing stuff is what you want to do with your life, it's no different to learning guitar. You need to practice every day. Mm. It can be boring sitting there practicing your scales, you know, but you got to do a bit of it every day. Just push yourself a little bit. Yeah. It's not always going to be fun.
Take it from me. It's easy to get frustrated, but if you overcome that frustration, something good will come out. I mean, 99% of the time, it's probably going to look like crap, or you're going to think it looks like crap, but the 1% is worth it.
Feeling that something looks like crap is a natural part of drawing something, I think. There are times when I've drawn something and I've gone, I'm not happy with it. And later on, I've learned some new trick. And I look back at the scene now, I'm like, oh man, if I just added this one little thing to the scene, it could have just taken it that whole new level. So it's all about experience. It's all about what you learn, you know. It's all important. Mm. But anyway, so I think that's a good start of the discussion about finding your own art style. I've actually run out of ginger beer, so I think we should probably wrap up the podcast.
What a tragedy. Okay.
I know.
Well, yeah. All right. Well, hopefully we will have another podcast sooner rather than later.
Can I just say, I find it quite hilarious that, like, last night, I went and did a podcast with someone else, and your jealousy instantly shows, because today you're like, oh man, let's do a podcast. I'm excited to do a podcast.
I was so inspired. Cute. It's not that. It's not jealousy. It was, I figured, you know what? We should do a podcast. We really should. Because you've been saying it forever. And okay, maybe I do feel like you're cheating on me a little bit. But that's not important.
Did you hear that, listeners? Did you hear that? I want to just point out that I'm always ready to do podcasts. So if you get angry because we don't do enough podcasts, don't direct your anger at me anymore, please.
It's totally my fault. It's totally my fault. I can't count the number of times that you've said, let's do a podcast. And I say, yeah, okay. And you say, let's do it right now. I'm like, I have better things to do. Like look at my butt in the mirror.
And cleaning your paws and whiskers.
Hush.
Anyway, what a delightful pod! I've had a really delightful time talking my ass off about boring things. So,
well,
let's
you
do
better
this again sometime.
You better pick it up and put it back on, or eat more pie face.
Delicious.
So, with that, I think we should end our podcast on this note, which is pie face,
pie face,
pie face,
pie face,
pie face,
pie face,
big butt. Stupid lag.
Good.